everybody got Bibles? Might be worth getting one. There's plenty in the entrance over there. The reason is that we're going to be looking at the life of Jacob, and he's obviously an Old Testament character. And I've got too many verses, so I'm going to skip over quite a few. But Jacob's life, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the three founding fathers of the Jewish race, and Abraham, who is called the father of all those who have faith, and you know, New Testament faith, it is said to be based on the faith of Abraham also. So they're important characters for us, not just because of, you know, the spiritual aspects, but physically they were important people too in their day, and they shaped the world of their day. So Jacob kicks off in Genesis 25, and then the last thing about him is in Genesis 49, so that's like 25 chapters mostly about him, although some of those chapters are about other people. There's a whole chapter on Esau and a little bit about a couple of chapters on Joseph in there. But there's a lot about Jacob. There's some significant chapters about him. So Genesis 25 is where we're kicking off. towards the end of that 23, verse 23. His birth. Before he was born, this is, his mother, these words were said to his mother, and the Lord said to her, so this is his mother, it's Jacob's wife, Rebecca, and not Jacob's wife, Isaac's wife, Rebecca, Jacob's mother. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. So she was presumably, as is the way I'm told, with pregnant women, they get a lot of kicking and punching going on. And there was obviously a bit of a battle going on inside her, and she knew something was up. And God said to her, it's because you've got twins in there, and they're having a bit of a tussle. And that's quite prophetic, because that's what really went on for most of their lives. The tussle, the struggle, the fight. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came forth red. All his body was like a hairy mantle. I think that's mantle as in, you know, like a cloak rather than the mantelpiece where your fire is. I don't think one of those would be very good if it was hairy. A hairy mantle. So they called his name Esau. Afterwards, his brother came forth, and his hand had taken hold of Esau's heel. So as Esau departed, there was a hand clutching his heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So Isaac, quite an old guy by this time, a little bit older than me. I'll be 60 next birthday. So glad we've got all that child rearing stuff out of the way well before now, I must say. But he had it all to come as a 60-year-old and upwards. Good on him. So Jacob, a tussler, tussling in the womb, fighting with his brother, grasping his heel. A grasper, even then, on this first seconds of birth. Before he was even fully born, he was grasping. Then we have some episodes mentioned in this same chapter. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. So Esau, the sporty, physically strong, fast, skillful hunter, probably nowadays would be an athlete, play football or rugby or something like that, and his brother would have been a librarian. Probably good doing a master's degree in something or other, and you know, a man of books. as is the way of most Jews these days, men of books, and probably who have glasses, if such things existed. Dwelling in tents, a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau. He liked the outward show, the strength, the physical fitness, the athleticism, the hunting, could catch animals and cook them. Isaac liked that. But Rebecca loved Jacob. Maybe she, because the angel had said to her, the older will serve the younger. So Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. So we get the first, this is the recording of the first devious episode in Jacob's life. And there were a number to come. Devious episodes. Crafty. Trying to engineer things to his way. He was the second out of the womb, but he tried to engineer and grasp that which was his brother's. The firstborn had rights back in those days. I think they do nowadays also, but more so in those days. There was the right of inheritance to the firstborn. The firstborn usually would receive 2/3 of the inheritance, or twice the lot, should we say. So if there was two brothers, they'd split it into a lot of two and a lot of one. So the youngest would get the one and the oldest would get the two. The firstborn son would get the double portion. So if there were 10 children, there would be 11 portions. The oldest would get two and all the others would get one. That seems to be the way it worked back in them days. But also there was another thing going on. There was the physical inheritance, you know, how many sheep and cattle you had, etc. But also there was the right to be in that line of God's blessing. You know, it could have been Abraham, Ishmael, Esau. But no, it wasn't. It was Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It could have been so different. So the way that man looks at it and the way God looks at it, different things. So, but Jacob, he craftily stole what was his brother's. His birthright to get the double portion of the inheritance. And also later, in the two chapters on, he stole Isaac's blessing. When the guy was old and he thought his days were up, he would call his sons to him and say, right, I'm about to pass on, go the way of all the earth, as they say. One of the last things they would do is to pass on the blessing to their sons or to their children. So Jacob must have thought his days were numbered. So he called his sons to him and he blessed them. But Jacob disguised himself as Esau. He put on, you know, skin so he was hairy and rough, and he impersonated his brother craftily, deviously. He impersonated his brother and made his father, who was getting a bit blind by that time, made his father think it was him. And he spoke like his brother. He brought some stew like his brother made, and he put hair on his arms and his neck, so that when his dad put his hand on him, he would think, that's Esau. I'll bless him. And he stole his father's blessing. And the blessing is like a spiritual inheritance, that God would bless that son, the one who was blessed, the one who had the blessing. So, three things about his early life: the grasping of the heel, the stealing of the birthright, and the stealing of the blessing. You can read up the detail, there's quite a lot of verses on it. But it just shows, paints a picture, doesn't it, of a devious character, a crafty person, a quiet bookworm type who felt that his only way of overcoming this sporty, physically fit guy was to deal deviously, using his brain and thinking things through, engineering circumstances to his advantage. And a poor old sporty guy, he was the patsy, he was the mug. He got done in both cases. And he regretted it later, but it was too late. There was a lot you could say about Jacob and his birth and his early life, but whatever you say, it seems he was, calling him devious, I think, is putting it kindly. And there was more to come. Were his actions justified? Well, I can't put my hand on my heart and say they were at all. I think they were. How can you say that was a good thing, what he did? But he did it. You might think, well, he's craftily deceived his father, but would God go along with this? You know, when it comes to the blessing of God on somebody's life, would God go along with what had happened? Would he support the devious way in which Jacob had defrauded his brother? You might think God would say, no, I'm not having that. It's Esau's. I'm going to bless Esau. I'm not going to bless Jacob at all. He's been devious. But it appears that God went along with it. When Isaac found out about the deception and about Jacob impersonating Esau, he was a bit gutted and angry about it, and he had the opportunity to change his blessing, but he said, no, what's done is done. He didn't change it. And it makes you think that words matter. In those days, nothing was written down. There was no written contract. It was done by words. And once the words were out from Isaac's mouth, he considered that was it enacted. That was it done. And his words had power and authority. And he didn't want to go back on his own word, even though he'd been deceived. Words have consequences and they matter. And words of blessing, therefore, they have currency with God, because God didn't go back on it either. And it had currency with God. It mattered to God, the fact that Isaac had blessed Jacob instead of Esau. A man's word used to be his bond, they say. Not sure that was ever particularly true. It's not very characteristic of modern life, but it should be characteristic of our lives. It should be that just as Isaac wouldn't go back on his word once spoken, we don't go back on our word once spoken. And we have to carefully think what we're going to say before we say it, so then we don't have to get in the situation Isaac found himself in. Why are words important? Why does it matter? Well, you could say, well, God could see the heart. God can see our hearts. He can see into us. He could see into Jacob, and he knew he was a devious man. And he could see into Esau and probably thought he's a bit of an empty man. But he could see the inner workings and machinations of all of us. Before the eyes of God, we're all open and laid bare. There's no hiding what we're like. But there's only God that sees that. Other people can't see it. People that we know can't see what we're like inside. They can hear, they can see what we do and what we say. They don't know what we're thinking and feeling. And words are the outward expression for the benefit of those who can't see inside. Jesus said this, didn't he, when he raised Lazarus from the dead, and he prayed to God in John 11. Just get that one up because I can't remember it. John 11:42. Jesus lifted his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. So God knew what Jesus was thinking, and he you know, whether Jesus had said things aloud to God or not, I reckon a lot of that was quiet prayer. But for the sake of those people who didn't have that ability, like all of us, Jesus said it out loud so that the listeners could hear his prayer and know that he was depending on God to raise Lazarus. Well, if Jesus had to do it, how much more we do? Our words have currency with God, not only with people around us, but also, I think, in heaven. You know, in the courtrooms of heaven where those elders are casting their crowns and decisions are being made that affect lives on earth. You know, why would God bless somebody and say, right, you angels, go and bless that person over there? And he'll say, well, hold on a minute. Other dissenting voices might say, why does he deserve that? What's happened in his life that's caused you to bless him? Well, he had this great heart, didn't he? He had these thoughts and intentions inside him. But they would say, well, we can't see any of that. What's he done and said? For the sake of the angels and for the sake of those in heaven, God requires our words and our actions. Because God can therefore be justified in the courts of heaven in his blessing of us, because he said, I'm only doing what I'm doing because of what he said and did. Not because of what was in his heart. What was in his heart needed to come out in action and in words. And words matter a lot. We know that the issue with Esau and Jacob was God's doing. Strangely, it was God's doing. God could see Jacob's heart. And therefore, that's why he was doing what he was doing. He loved Jacob. And relatively speaking, he hated Esau. Did he really hate Esau? I don't think so. He blessed Esau greatly. And there's a whole chapter about Esau's blessing later on. But Malachi 1:2 says that God loved Jacob and hated Esau. And that's quoted in Romans as the basis for God's dealing with us nowadays. God can see our hearts. And what it was in Jacob, there was a heart that wanted God. It was longing for God, but he felt that he didn't really trust God, and he had to engineer things for himself. And we see this struggle all through his life. A heart that basically wanted God's thing. He wanted the birthright. He wanted the blessing of God on his life. He knew there was such a thing. And Esau thought it was cheap and not worth anything. But Jacob said, I know that the blessing of God matters. I want it, and I'll get it my own way. And deviously he got it. And God, because he saw his heart and knew what was there, he seems to have put up with the deviousness. Don't know why he did that, but he's playing the long game. God is. He's playing the long game, and he knows the end from the beginning. And he can see inside of us. Clearly, as Jacob's life began to unfold, there was a lot more evidence that God was in fact working in his life. But at this stage, he was nowhere near the finished article. Nowhere near. Due to his actions in the cheating of Esau, Esau was really angry with him and swore to kill him. And he said, as soon as my dad's dead, he's got it. I'm getting him. It's a bit like Fredo, isn't it? Godfather. As soon as his mother dies, that's it. Esau swore to kill Jacob once his dad had died. And so Jacob, in fear of his life, knew he had to get out of there. And conveniently, his mother said, well, I've got a scheme. She also was a schemer. In fact, they all were schemers. Rebecca, a schemer. Rebecca. What am I talking about? They're all from that place in northern Syria, Padam Aram, Arameans. Devious people they must be. All of them. Why Abraham would say, go and get a wife for my son from that lot instead of the locals? Well, they hated the locals, the Canaanites, and they didn't hate so much the Arameans who were in Padam Aram, northern Syria. They had good hearts, but they were devious and crafty. Perhaps that was something they valued. I don't think so. Anyway, his mother said, well, you better get off to Paddan Aram. Can we have the map up, by the way? Get the map, so you know what's going on.
There we go. There's a map. Right. There's the map, and I didn't draw this map. I just cribbed it off the internet, as you do. Gone. There, it's back again. Okay. Padan Aram is right up the top, through the roof, 10 foot above the tiles. It's in northern Syria, 200 miles north. And that red arrow is pointing up where he was going. So all this was going on down here in Beersheba, where it says Negev. There. And they cleared off 200 miles further north to go and get yourself a wife from the Arameans at Padan Aram. So that seemed a convenient excuse to escape, and that's what they did. What he did. So Jacob then was off on his way along that road up there. And while he was there, the next scene happened. He had his first encounter with God. Jacob went out from Beersheba, went towards Haran. Beersheba, Haran right up the top. He came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it on at his head and lay down at that place to sleep. And he dreamed. And behold, a ladder was set up on the earth and its top reached to heaven. And the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done what I've spoken to you. And so God appeared to him at there, near Luz. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. So he didn't see it while he was awake. While he was asleep, he dreamt it. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone that he had as his pillow, set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. And he called up the name of that place Bethel, hence Bethel. The name of that city had been Luz previously. Jacob made a vow saying, if God be with me, and keep me in this way that I'm going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I've set as a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me I will surely give a tenth to you. So he had this vision of God, and when he awoke it was so real to him, and he thought, this is real, really, this has really happened. Apparently this is something happening today all over the Islamic world. People are having dreams about Jesus. And it's so real that when they wake up, that they think, I've got to start worshipping Jesus. And some whole villages have been turned to Christ. You think, well, missionaries get put to death when they go there, but it doesn't stop God. God can go into your mind, into your sleep. He looks inside, he can put things inside. So God did that in Jacob's life, and he knew it was real. Sometimes when you have dreams, you think, was that real? Did God really do that? And that's something I think we need to take on board, that it could be that God is speaking to us in our dreams. Anyway, it was akin to a conversion experience for Jacob. You might expect, therefore, that after that event, all his dealings from then on would be sweetness and light, and he would be deviousness out the window. In comes wholesomeness and true dealings, being nice to people, being honest and above board, No, forget that. There was very little evidence of any of that in his life. It seems that whilst God had made a definite start in his life, there was a long way to go, quite literally. Anyway, he went to Paddan Aram, through the roof, 20 feet up, 200 miles away, and worked there for his uncle, Laban. Well, the man who became his uncle, actually, was more like his second cousin. Both descended from the same great-grandfather, second or third cousin, or second cousin first removed, or whatever it is. And he became his uncle, because he worked in, and he married the two daughters of Laban. Laban cut from the same stuff as Jacob, as devious as him, possibly more so. They were all idolaters, and they had idols and worshipped idols, and their character was devious. Laban tricked Jacob into having Leah instead of Rachel, and he worked for him in the end 21 years in the land of Paddan Aram. And in the end there was a dispute, an ongoing dispute, it seems to be the way with his life, about sheep and goats, and he tricked Laban out of a load of goats. Well, there's a surprise, didn't see that one coming. Anyway, 21 years in all. Genesis 29 covers a lot of that passage. And finally, at the end of it, in Genesis 31:13, God appears to him a second time. And it says, Genesis 31:13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. So God, I don't know if this is a dream now or a vision, or whether he just heard the voice, doesn't say. God had heard his vow. You know, God said some things to him, and he made the vow, didn't he? If God really be with me, then I'll do this and that. And God heard that vow. He saw him anointing the pillar, which was his pillow, and pouring oil on it, and he heard his vow. So, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. So what Jacob did and what Jacob said, God heard it and saw it. And it mattered to him. His words mattered. His actions mattered. They're not empty things. What we do and say, it matters. It may not matter much to the people around us, but it matters where it really counts. It matters where it matters. God heard it. So, he may have been a devious, crafty sort, but he did seem to listen to God. When God said things to him, he did do it. So he was obedient. So that's a good thing in his favour. So, back up there, out of the roof, he set back up on his journey back to Bethel, where God had appeared to him the first time. And he went up probably the red route and came back down this green route, which is the normal way. And if you're wondering about why they took these routes, you need to understand rainfall and geomorphology of the land. And the routes are basically in between places that where people lived. And all the stuff to the right, probably with that green line, is where there was almost no rainfall. 4 inches a year, that sort of desert types. But in the valley and further to the left, plenty of rainfall, or relatively larger amount of rainfall. Not as much as we have, obviously. And clearly not that much. But there was enough to live and to graze flocks. So that's why the significance of the roots. So Jacob went on his way back down the green road, down this way. And when he got to this place, Mahanaim, Genesis 32:1. So Jacob went on his way, and by this time, of course, he went up there on his own, one man, and he came back with two wives and quite a few kids, 10 kids, and a load of sheep and goats and stuff. So a lot bigger party. And all the way back he's thinking, Esau will be there. Got to deal with Esau. He'll be after my blood still, probably. Will I survive it? when he got to that place, he says the angels of God met him. Didn't say they said anything or did anything, but they met him. So it was a physical thing that he saw. Angels, oh goodness me, the angels are still here. They've been here all that time I've been away and they're still here. I don't need to be so afraid. Angels are still with me. Jacob saw them and he said, this is God's camp. And he called that name of that place Machaneim. Just on the right there, on the river Jabbok. He then had a big prayer, pleading with God to protect him, because he knew that he was going to have to deal with Esau. In his prayer, he quoted the earlier things that God had said to him in Genesis 31 and Genesis 28. So he knew what God had said to him. He'd been thinking about them and dwelling on them, and he hadn't forgotten. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I'll deal well with you. I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and all the truth which you have shown your servant, for I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I've become two large companies. He deviously split his crowd into two lots, three lots even, so that his Esau would maybe kill one of them, but two would survive. Anyway, he delivered me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. Well, done about the mother. There was four mothers and 10 children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So he's fighting with God, really, in the words, and trying to grasp hold of what God has said, pleading with God to protect him. Then he has this weirdest, the only encounter with God of its kind, I think. Never heard of any others. Back half of Genesis 32. All the others had crossed over the river. The river crossing was near Penuel, just there near Machaneim. And after they'd all gone over the river and he was left on his own again, a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw, i.e. the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. So that's the angel saying, let me go, or the man. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said, what is your name? He said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. And Jacob asked, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And he said, why is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. So the angel never revealed who he was, but Jacob took it as that he was one of the angels, perhaps one of the ones he'd seen at previous day at Machaneim. So God's work in his life stepped up a level. And like his grandfather before him, he was given a new name. We like to think of God's dealings with us as all being good, don't we? I mean, we think of them all being, surely it has to all be good stuff. But he had his hip put out. For the rest of his life he walked with a limp. Frankly, I don't fancy that very much. It's not what I like. It's not what I would call good. However, it was good for Jacob because it made him trust God more and trust himself less. So we need to look at God's perspective on things. Is having a limp a good thing? Well, it could be. In God's economy, it could be a good thing. Better to limp and follow closely with God. Jesus said much the same about eyes. Better to gouge out your eyes, isn't he, than to sin with them. Jesus may have been speaking figuratively. I don't know. Maybe he was being literal. In this case, it was definitely literal. He touched his hip joint and he was out of joint. and didn't go back in nicely into the socket. He limped the rest of his life. So it was literal. He damaged Jacob's body permanently. You could say that in this struggle with the angel, that Jacob eventually abandoned fighting and he abandoned self-defense, and he clung on to the angel and said, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And that's a picture of our lives. We have to stop fighting with God and fighting with life and cling on to God and saying, I want you to bless me. It's important that you bless me. And the angel did and changed his name. And that's another picture of our Christian life, isn't it? That we have moved on. We're no longer ourselves. We've been given his name. We're children of God. In some cultures, they actually change their names when they become believers and give them a Christian name. In our culture, we were born and given Christian names at birth or at whenever, when we were registered. My dad got it wrong. He called me the same as he called my brother. So I had to be registered twice. I don't know if he'd been drinking or what. I was registered where I was born, and I was registered about a month later. En route back from where we lived to England. I was registered in Sri Lanka, in Colombo, with a proper name and not my brother's name. Truth is what was needed. Truth was not something Jacob had much of. He was always trying to engineer things. But to trust God, could he trust God when there was the real threat of Esau? Esau, by this time, 20-odd years on, become a mighty clan. It was already fearsome to start with. We had big crowds now following him. Perhaps now, after this second or third encounter with God, you might start to see some honesty and truth in Jacob's life. But, sorry, no, not quite. He continued in his well-trodden ways. Trust was still a long way off. He had this encounter with Esau, and Esau said to him, come and live with us down in Seir. So Esau lived down here, this part, this hill country here, the hill country of Seir, where the Horites lived. And Esau basically made it his own, and he'd fought the Horites and defeated them, and it became called Moab. Because that was Esau's nickname, Moab. And the Moabites lived there. Edomites, not Moabites. Forget that. Edomites lived there. The Moabites lived there. So, Edom is red, I think. So, Esau saying, come and live with me down here. We'll all be fine. We'll be one together. But I think what's happening with Jacob is thinking, yeah, okay, we'll do that. Deceitfully telling his brother, yeah, we'll do that. You go on first and I'll follow afterwards. No, what really happened was his brother came down here, down this King's Road, back to the land of Seir. He nipped across the river, firstly to Succoth and then back to Shechem, because God had said to him, go back to Bethel where you first met. So he knew he was on his journey back the way God had told him, and to be diverted to where his brother lived would have been wrong. And he was, in fact, recreating the exact journey Abraham took. So he had respect for his grandfather's life and his grandfather's legacy. And that's something that we need to take on board, that we trust the legacy of our parents and grandparents if they've got a Christian background. What did they want for us? And what did they do for God? And what promises did God give them? In my case, I don't know of any promises of God or dealings with God in my immediate ancestors. Maybe there was further back that I'm not aware of. I'm looking forward to finding out about that someday. But in his case, he knew pretty well Isaac's dealings with God, and he knew pretty well Abraham's dealings with God, and he was recreating Abraham's walk. I think it's a good thing just to pause for a second. Thing that's the fact that this deceitfulness of Jacob is mentioned so often, and lying and untruth. If you'd been writing this story yourself, you would have glossed over a lot of this, and you would have said it, the father of the Israeli nation, if you were a Jew writing it, like Moses, you might have thought, let's put our patriarchs in a good light. But no, there was none of that. They pointed out all the flaws of Abraham and all the flaws of Jacob. And Joseph didn't seem to have any flaws. That's a good thing, isn't it? But most of the others, full of flaws, and they're all recorded. Lots of them are recorded for our benefit. It's an honest account. And never does it say something like, and this happened, and later on that would lead to such a thing. No, there's none of that. That's how we would do it. We would say, oh, this was the important point, and later on it would come back to haunt him. And that's what you do in sermons. But it was a literal writing down of what really happened. No, not much commentary. And not much glossing over. So Jacob was on his journey back towards Bethel, where he'd had his first encounter. When he was at Shechem, which is north of Bethel, he pitched his tent and he bought a parcel of land from the children of Shechem's father, and he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. So he called an altar after his new name. So it stuck that God had given him a new name, and he sort of embodied that in an altar, God, the God of Israel. Then he went on his way back to Bethel. Well, actually, in Genesis 35, 1, God appeared to him a further time, and he said, arise, go up to Bethel and live there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. So he's continually reminding him of his past events. So Jacob, whilst at Shechem, modern day Nablus, in what we call the West Bank, I've been there, he was living there, and God said, go up to Bethel and live there instead. And a very significant thing happened. Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way out which I've gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods who were in their hands and the earrings that were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were around them. And they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. So significant things going on in his life now. He was cleaning up his act, getting rid of the gods, the false gods, the idols, and the earrings which were features of that religion, and burying it all. And not just him, but all the people with him. His wife, who was an idolater, she buried her idol. Also, so he was recreating the journey Abraham, his father, had made in Genesis 12, Haran to Succoth to Shechem to Bethel. So he was showing signs of spirituality at last, that was to be tested. God doesn't just let us get away with life easy. On this journey from Shechem back to Beersheba. Sorry. Oh, got ahead of myself. Shechem to Bethel. Well, and finally on to Beersheba. At Shechem, his oldest confidant, or his mother Rebecca's maid, died, and he buried her there by a tree, and they called it Alon Bakuth, which means oak of weeping. So things, some bad things start to happen. At Bethel, God appeared to him again and reiterated many of the same things he'd said before. But also he said, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. So he's repeating what he'd said previously. And God also said, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. Same thing said to Adam. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac I give to you, and to your descendants after you I give this land. So then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone. And he poured a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. And he called that place Bethel. So some repetition of earlier things, but more spirituality in it this time. And then they carried on back to see his father, this area where his father had been living, or maybe there, but actually encountered him en route. On that journey, Rachel gave birth to her final son, her second son, Benjamin, but she died in childbirth, and Jacob buried her near Bethlehem. So that's there. Ephrath. Reuben, his oldest son. Fathers love their oldest sons, but Reuben slept with one of his wives, one of Jacob's wives, and it disgusted Jacob, and he never forgot it till the end of his days. And this woman was Dan and Naphtali's mother. And Reuben slept with his wife's maid Bilhah. How disappointing for Jacob. And then finally, when he met his father at last, his father died. And Esau and Jacob buried him. So that's the journey after the spirituality was starting to set in, and he was starting to become much more godly, and he put away the idols. Some key things happened that tested his faith. Would he stay firm? Or would he buckle? And that's going to come to us. Don't think that spiritual life will be easy. There will be things that hurt and are painful, and we're in a battle. And do we expect everything to be easy in the battle? If there really are two worlds, and we're living in the physical world, but there's a spiritual one around us with angels and God speaking to people, do we expect it will be easy? There'll be opposition to us. The spiritual life is always opposed. And we've encountered that ourselves. Most of you probably have had the experience where you've had a significant blessing from God, and then within days of that, some significant temptation or disappointment or trial has happened. Maybe bad health or other things have come fast on the heels of some blessing from God. And it's the enemy trying to take you off route, like Esau was trying to get him off route and say, come down here. But no, he was determined to go the route that God had told him. Even if he had to lie to his brother. Anyway, he got back to where his father lived, and they lived there quite a few years. The picture in Genesis shifts then to the life of Joseph and the business with the famines in Egypt. And Jacob, quite an old man, by the time he was 120, he went into Egypt with his whole family to join Joseph. And God spoke to him again in Genesis 46:1. So Israel, he's been called Israel now, Jacob, name of the past, now known as Israel. Jacob took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. So he was probably living here around this area where Machpelah's where Abraham's buried, and Sarah in the cave, Machpelah. So they lived around there. He came on his way now from Machpelah to Beersheba, and then on the way to Egypt down that way. And he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac at Beersheba. And God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. Why not Israel, Israel? Here am I. I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. So he thought that Joseph was dead. 20 years he'd been mourning the death of his beloved second youngest son, Joseph, the firstborn of his loved wife, Rachel. And so he went down to Egypt. And at that point, Joseph introduces him to Pharaoh, the richest man in the world, probably. In the known world, anyway. And normally, it says in the Bible that the greater blesses the lesser. The richest man in the world, Jacob or Israel, blessed him. The greater blesses the lesser. Spiritually greater than materially rich Pharaoh. It's thought, modern archaeology is now saying, or various things are saying, that during the various phases of the Egyptian Empire, those who were at Pharaoh's at that time were probably Semites. You know, previous incursions of people from Canaan and from the area where they came from. So it's quite likely that they were distant relatives, and that might be why Pharaoh granted them to live there, and not only to live there, but give them the best bit of the land in Goshen. So, but Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. 130. Few and evil have been the days of my life, and they've not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. So he was basically thinking, my life's not been very good, not been as good as my father and my grandfather. But he was to live a further 7 years, during which time I think he changed. Maybe he had a lot more time for meditation. Maybe he was just overjoyed because Joseph was there and Joseph had children of his own. And we get the final passage about his life. And if you look in Hebrews 11, where it talks about the men of faith, this is the bit that's quoted in Hebrews 11. All of those visitations to Joseph aren't mentioned, but the thing that gets mentioned in Hebrews 11:21, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. Didn't seem that significant. After all those other things. And, you know, the way he blessed them, famous prayer, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. It's obviously from Yorkshire. Let my name be named among them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So later on, he gave Joseph a double portion in the inheritance in when they took over Canaan. They got a double portion. The portion of the eldest son was given to Joseph. He was the eldest son of his favourite wife, Rachel. He got the double portion. So Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons, they got a portion each. And all the other 10 sons got one portion. And Levi just got a few cities. So a double portion to the sons of Joseph. And in the blessing of when he came to die and he called his 12 sons to him, and he was going to pass on his dying blessing to them, and he recounted to each of the 12 sons, pretty heinous things were said about several of them, especially Reuben, who had slept with his own wife, even though he started off and said, "You were the brightness of my glory," or whatever. It really started off well, "But you slept with my wife." So he didn't say much about them. And the next two, Simeon and Levi, said, "You're evil." And it wasn't until he got to Judah that he started saying good things. And Judah and Joseph, out of the 12, are given the what you might call positive blessing. You know, Genesis 49:10 about Judah: "The scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes, until to him shall belong the obedience of the people." So he was looking at Judah, his number four son, and foreseeing, prophesying, that from him would be most of the kings of Israel, and eventually the Messiah, Shiloh, peace. So I think in those 7 years he spent time with God, and that obviously God had shown him some extra things. And there was a clear prophecy of the coming Messiah. And then to Joseph, "The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors." So in that 7 years since his encounter with Pharaoh, he started to think, actually, my life has exceeded the lives of Abraham and Isaac. I've now been blessed more by God than either of them. "The blessings of your father," saying this to Joseph, "the blessings of me have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separated from his brothers." So it seems that at the end of his life he'd eventually come to terms with his position in God's plan for him. It's a massive plan and a long journey. And he at last saw that his life had been blessed even more than Abraham and Isaac. He'd struggled with the pressure of being Abraham and Isaac's descendant. And even though he'd wanted that blessing on his life, he'd struggled and engineered and cheated his way to get it. And God met with him directly 6 times, 7 if you count the angels at Mahanaim. And they were the major points of his life. But his character changed very slowly until fairly late on in his life. So I'll just leave you with that. But I just want to say that in our journey with God, in your journey with God, and my journey with God, it might be seeming to go very slow, and nothing might seem to happen for 10 or even 22 years, as it happened in there. Not much going on, no massive words from God. But you can still be in God's plan. And it might be that as an old man, you enter into a new phase of blessing. I personally feel that's what's happened to me, that I'm entering into a new phase of God's blessing. I had been afraid of responsibility and stuff like that, what God might ask me to do, but God can give you what you need for the next phase of your life. And don't be thinking, "I'm 60 now, I'm going to hang up my boots and retire and do nothing." God doesn't have retirement. That doesn't feature. Those of you who have retired, it doesn't feature in the way God works. Our relationship with him continues. We may not be ploughing fields and herding goats, but we can still be listening to God. And our character might change very slowly. And some of you might think, "I've never really changed at all." And some of you might be thinking, "Some of the others haven't really changed at all." But God can work with us at his pace. He's extremely patient. And he will get his way if we let him. Jacob let him eventually do what he wanted to do. So let's just pray. Father, we thank you that you are extremely patient with us. Thank you that you haven't blotted us out from the face of the earth yet. Despite the way we've followed poorly and disobeyed often, you haven't seen fit to wash your hands of us yet. And we know that you won't, because you promise you will never leave us or forsake us. Thank you that you are fulfilling in our lives the promises you gave to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and more especially to Jesus, your own son, that we have been given to you and to Jesus, and that our lives are safeguarded. Our eternity is written for us. It's already there to be grasped, and our lives need to grasp onto it and hold on despite the current circumstance has not been so favourable, we need to hold on to you until you bless us. But we'd be like Jacob, I will not let go until you bless me. And as his life eventually, he came to understand that you had blessed him, I pray that we would come to understand your dealings with us have been for our good. And the way you've worked in our lives has been according to your master plan for our benefit. And we pray that we, and our, either ourselves or our immediate descendants, will be those who see you coming down with the clouds of heaven. When you return, Lord, to this earth to take up your place, I want either my eyes or the eyes of my descendants to see that. And we pray, Lord, that you'd do that for your name's sake. Amen.